This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. How many of you are paranoid about artificial intelligence worming its way into your personal life? Well, fortunately, the experts are keeping up on this. And in fact, the latest report on the progress of artificial intelligence has just come out. Let's go to Alan Boyle at GeekWire to find out what it says. First of all, who does this? Who issues this report?
Well, it's a group of experts convened by Stanford, and it was put together by a Stanford alumnus, Eric Horvitz, who happens to be Microsoft's chief scientific officer. And he had the idea to do this as actually a 100-year study.
When did it start?
It started 5 years ago, so we got a ways to go.
Okay, so as you look this over, let's cut right to the scariest thing that it finds. What's the scariest thing in the study?
The scariest thing is that things are moving faster, and there's good news to that, but there's also bad news that we're starting to see some issues crop up. It's not as if Terminator is out to get us, but there are issues like what they call algorithmic bias. That means that the computer can be just as racist as humans can be. Also, the idea of facial recognition software and how it can be used for surveillance. Deep fakes, if anybody's come across a video that makes it look as if somebody is doing something they wouldn't normally be doing, it could be a video that was created using AI that doesn't reflect reality. We're starting to see those things come up quicker than maybe the experts thought 5 years ago.
Well, deep fakery is what worries me, but I mean, except for the various demonstrations that are clearly labeled as deep fakes, as far as I know, nobody has tried to deep fake Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer or Joe Biden, have they?
Well, they have. Videos have been altered to make it look as if Joe Biden is doing things that would look bad, and the same with Nancy Pelosi.
So I'm familiar with the one that slowed down Nancy Pelosi, but that one was pretty obvious. Biden, depending on the speech, you know, he can slow himself down. So I don't know that that's going to be a real problem.
Well, that's the thing, that there's some plausibility. That was another thing that came up in the AI report, is that bots and AI analysis can lead you in directions that you might be more likely to go to, and it can tailor the message. And we've seen that in political campaigns.
Right. Let's talk about that for a moment. Okay, let's suppose somebody deepfakes Joe Biden, you know, declaring nuclear war on China. I thought that the AI scientists were working on a way to put an indelible watermark on the original, so that if a reporter wants to figure out if this is real or not, there's a place to go.
That's right. People are working on systems for verification in that way, and sometimes even using AI to verify whether something has been faked. But the problem is, as you know, Dave, it's one thing to painstakingly verify the authenticity of something, and it's another thing to be able to disseminate that as quickly as the original disinformation. That's a big issue. I'm a little worried that we're talking so much about the concerns that people are going to think that AI is this big bad thing. And the other side of the report is that there are some benefits that we're seeing already. And if you ever use Netflix or use your spam filter on an email program, that's where you're getting the benefit of AI as well. So it's not a completely dark story that this report is telling.
Yeah. Also in medicine, right? I understand that it's being used to create error-free surgery.
And also, I think medical diagnosis, and it's not going to be as if you go to a robot doctor, but the doctor can use an AI-enabled tool to provide a better diagnosis. And that's been shown in scientific studies, that AI can improve the quality of a diagnosis done by a human doctor.
Yeah. Now, to get all cosmic about it, we're only 5 years into this 100-year study, but I imagine one of the things they're going to look into is whether at some point AI gets so good, and if we ever perfect a quantum computer, I mean, we're talking about a system that could think on the scale of a human brain, right? Could it achieve consciousness and start and free will? And you know, then that's it.
I love it. I love where you're going with this, Dave. We're not anywhere near that yet, but I'm imagining a time, you know, 90 years from now when the AI is going to write this report.
That's
and
right.
Say, you know, everything worked out perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Who's to say that you and I aren't the results of an AI project of some earlier civilization, now long vanished.
Now you're getting into, you know, the idea is life a simulation, which I think is beyond the scope of this report.
The thing that concerns me, though, because it has happened to me time from time working remotely from home, is what do you do when everything blue screens, right? Actually happened during this morning's broadcast where it froze. Luckily, I have a backup. But I'm wondering if we might be, it's sort of like when you start building buildings that are 100, 200 stories. To me, that's a disaster waiting to happen. And are we getting to that point with computers where eventually we will be so dependent on them that we can never turn them off, and that if something goes wrong, there's no backup?
Well, again, turning to the report, that's one of the things that came out, that people have to be engaged in using computers and using machine intelligence in what they're doing, that you can't just kind of let it be a black box. And so I agree with you that there's a cautionary tale in all this, is that the humans do have to remain in the loop. And I think we're seeing some pushback on that already. You know, I would point to the case of facial recognition and the outcry that arose, you know, because there were some not so cool things happening with that technology. So I don't think we should just let ourselves be totally tended by machines. And I think that's one of the big things that came through in the report.
Here's the other thing. What if one day, for whatever reason, Microsoft, God forbid, went out of business and stopped maintaining Windows? We are completely at the mercy of updates, right? Every so often your computer shuts off and comes back a new machine with new updates that nobody understands, except maybe two or three people over there in Redmond. But what if that company someday goes out of business? Civilization's over.
Mm-hmm. Well, that might be beyond the scope of the AI report. Although, who knows, maybe in 50 years, that will be a big thing. This is the last report out of the 100 years because we can't do this anymore. Yeah. But I'm with you, Dave, on this whole idea of obsolescence. For example, when I worked at NBC, we put together dozens of Flash interactives, and now Flash no longer exists. Yeah. And so all that has been lost to the ages. I can't tell you how many stories that I've written for my online career that are now no longer available because the servers changed.
Yep. Alan Boyle from GeekWire. Alan, thank you very much.
Really enjoyed the chat. Thank you so much, Dave.
On Fridays, our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us for All Over the Map, which is a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, the forgotten origins and anniversary of a monument to the very first ascent of Mount Rainier. Felix?
Morning, Dave. Yeah, it's so nice to see Mount Rainier covered in snow once again after that very disturbing snow-free look it went with for most of the past few months. Now, about 10 days ago, I saw some photos on social media of a stone monument on the mountain along the Skyline Trail, not far from Paradise. It commemorates the first time human reached the summit back in August 1870. I'd never seen or heard of it before, so I reached out to David Winfrey, who'd posted them, and we have those photos at My Northwest. Winfrey found the monument pretty moving, especially the setting, and so I did a little research, and the backstory is pretty cool. It's a big bench made of stones that were gathered nearby and held together with concrete. A few of the stones are engraved with the names of the first two climbers. That's Philemon Beecher Van Trump and Hazard Stevens, son of the first territorial governor Isaac Stevens, by the way. It also mentions the indigenous man Sluiskin, who guided Van Trump and Stevens on their climb and tried to talk them out of it because it was so dangerous. The monument is in the spot where Sluiskin waited, kind of a base camp, while the two climbers made the summit, and Sluiskin Falls is nearby too. Now, the park held a 48th anniversary event for the first climb back in August 1918, and Hazard Stevens was there. He was in his late 70s, Van Trump and Sluiskin had already passed away, and Stevens took a walk to go admire the glacier named after him, and he pointed out to someone the campsite where Sluiskin had waited for the two, and somebody had the bright idea to mark the spot with stones, and they built a cairn right then and there. Mm-hmm. And then Hazard Stevens died about 7 weeks later. And by the next summer, those two famous local outdoor clubs, Seattle's Mountaineers and Portland's Mazamas, they decided to build the monument. And plans were to dedicate it by the 49th anniversary in August 1919, but there were delays getting permission from the park. Red tape even in 1919. Finally, on September 22nd, 1921, that's 100 years ago this past Wednesday, the stone bench was dedicated. And UW Professor Edmund Meany was there. He was president of the Mountaineers. He's a famous local historian and author. And he was an old friend of Hazard Stevens. He'd written a poem for the 1918 event, which he read again in 1921. But my favorite line from Meany's remarks 100 years ago aren't from the poem. It is poetic, though, and pretty prescient. Meany said this, "These ceremonies will soon be forgotten, but this monument will endure." And sure enough, here we are 100 years later, uncovering the backstory, which hasn't been shared for a very long time. I want to thank David Winfrey for sharing his photos, which we do have in My Northwest. And Christina Ciari of the Mountaineers, she tracked down this annual report from 1921, which had all these details, and this great old photo, which we also have at My Northwest. So thanks for everybody's help for making the story come together. And 100 years ago this week, they marked that first climb of Mount Rainier.
Yes, and thanks to you, it is not forgotten, Felix.
Yes.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Here is the host of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. So, we are a week since I last asked you the question, a little bit closer to the fiscal cliff. Is the debt ceiling going to be lifted?
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has said she won't allow for a government shutdown and the matters will be resolved. But the questions are, how do you actually do that? Can Democrats get aligned within their own party? Can Republicans get out of the way of having this go through and not use some of these fiscal cliffs, as you refer to them, as a partisan tool? This is, once again, at the heart of what I think frustrates so many Americans, which looks like, you know, there's partisan political bickering about something that has nothing to do really with the ins and outs of policies that affect America. But for Republicans, what they would argue is Democrats want to have a party line vote through reconciliation, through this muscling through this $3.5 trillion spending package with all sorts of social programs in it. And if they want to do that, then they have to be, as Mitch McConnell has argued, the Senate Minority Leader, they have to be transparent with the full bill and vote on it themselves as all Democrats. And so that's what this political jousting is about, is making that point.
Okay, help settle a few dinner table arguments over who is truly responsible. Your job is to be objective. If we go over the cliff, is there a villain we can objectively blame? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, I mean, I think for a lot of America, all of Washington is looking like they can't shoot straight, right? Like you have the weaponization of these funding arguments that has been happening for years now, with the Republicans in control and now the Democrats in control. The minority leader, Mitch McConnell, would say, look, Democrats, you control the White House, you control the Senate, you control the House. This is your party. You're responsible. And Democrats would say, why are you making this partisan? Because this is just sort of basic housekeeping we are all responsible for. Mm-hmm. So,
but they linked it to the other bill. They didn't, they're not passing it.
Right.
I mean, they could have proposed just a clean debt ceiling increase if they wanted
to,
right? But they did not.
The Democrats.
Yeah.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's sort of TBD. There's going to be a lot of negotiating over the weekend.
Let's talk about January 6th. It looks like the investigation is getting real. They're going to subpoena, sounds like, everybody except Trump. What's the behind-the-scenes thing? Is there a general feeling that, in fact, there was an organized coup attempt underway in the White House?
I think coup is a very strong word. I haven't heard the select committee members actually say they have any evidence of that. I think what they are seeking is evidence of exactly what the chief of staff, Mark Meadows in particular, was doing and communicating in advance of this massive rally that turned into a violent storming of the Capitol at this key moment with the certification of the election. So there is this attempt to trace back, was there a direct line between the president himself and the actions on Capitol Hill? Was this more than just inspiration? Was there actual execution of a plan here? And there are others involved, the deputy chief of staff, people like Steve Bannon, who used to work at the White House. And so these are the very first subpoenas, and it is escalating. It is really kind of a shot across the bow.
Yeah. You're going to be talking with the president of Turkey this weekend and the prime minister of Australia. So speaking of President Biden's foreign policy, this was billed as one of his core competencies. Mm-hmm. He seems to be on the ropes. The special envoy to Haiti resigned over a disagreement on how to treat the refugees. Poll numbers continue to be down. Are Democrats worried by any of this?
They're going to have to be if they aren't already, not just on the approval, but on the general perception once again, that even with one party in control of the White House and the Senate and the House, that Washington isn't able to come to any real agreement on major legislative priorities. So on the foreign policy front, where Joe Biden has argued he had incredible skill and competence, the chaotic way that the U.S. withdrawal was executed, with European allies complaining they weren't fully consulted, and you know they had 5,000 NATO troops on the ground, so they had skin in the game. That happening, the dispute over whether the U.S. was fully transparent with our French allies about the deal we were striking with Australia over billions of dollars worth of nuclear submarine contracts. I mean, there are real problems for the Biden administration's foreign policy team, but on the domestic front as well, coming back to that, that is really kind of what is at stake, is can the domestic priorities that the Biden administration has articulated get through and get muscled through even on a party line vote? So this is not even a Democrat-Republican disagreement. This is Democrats disagreeing with each other on the president's key agenda items. And they know the clock is ticking against the 2022 congressional races. And being able to show that having Democrats in power breaks through some of these, you know, partisan lines is not something they've been able to demonstrate so far.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you.
Choke points. Brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. Repairs to the closed West Seattle Bridge are about to start, and Chris was able to get a tour inside the cracking concrete structure yesterday. So what was that like, and how do you get in there?
Well, it's actually pretty neat, Dave, because first thing I got to do is I got to drive through the closed construction zone there after 99. So I felt like I was doing something wrong. And then we drove up the wrong way of the ramp to get all the way up to the top of the bridge.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you, it was nice to get up there. I mean, 140 feet above the Duwamish River on a sunny afternoon. It was beautiful. 360-degree views of Puget Sound, the city.
Yeah, but there's cracks in it.
Well, it doesn't matter if you forget how beautiful of a drive that is if you haven't been there in forever, because you're raised up, you see over the port, you see down the waterfront. It really is beautiful. But I wasn't just there to take pretty pictures, which you can see at mynorthwest.com. It wasn't sightseeing. The Seattle Department of Transportation's Heather Marks highlighting that the work to repair the cracking bridge is set to begin in November.
We are on schedule and on budget, exactly as we expected. We're in really good shape. We are just finishing with our 90% design review process, so we're getting closer and closer to that day when we will start actual rehabilitation construction.
SDOT bridge engineer Matt Donahue, also along with us, he says that the cause of the cracking was the steel inside the concrete.
And although they designed the bridge with post-tensioning strand to the standards of the time, it turned out to be not strong enough for the bridge to carry out its useful life as designed.
So it wasn't bad concrete, it wasn't the seismic activity, it was the steel that failed. Now, that was the fun part. We were on top, we did those interviews up on top, and then there was this giant box there at kind of the apex of the bridge. We're like, okay, what's that? And that's where I looked inside, and there was this tiny hole and some scaffolding and a couple of really, really thin ladders, and we had to climb down through that hole, navigate a couple of ladders to get into the floor of the concrete box girder that supports the road and distributes the weight above. In fact, there are holes in the bottom of that floor. You could look down and see the Duwamish River. And it didn't seem
so
like
it's
that concrete.
Hollow under there. That's all hollow.
Yeah. The underside, when we say a box girder, just imagine drawing a box and then just driving through it. It's kind of like a tunnel underneath the roadway there. That's what the box girder is, supporting and distributing the weight. The steel goes through that concrete and is tightened at either end. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting. It was dark, and I was looking down at the Duwamish River and going, And then you start looking at the walls, and here you see all these cracks and all these Sharpie marks along the side where they've been tracking the growth of these cracks. Handwritten notes with the dates to see how far they've... It's kind of like when your kids were little and you'd put a mark above their head on the wall.
Yeah.
This is how tall they've grown. This is
growth chart.
And
this
there
is
was
a crack
long,
chart.
Yeah, this they were really, 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 really long. Some of the cracks were so small I didn't even notice till I got up there and, you know, really looked at them. And then in the middle of that open box girder, there was this the temporary shoring repair, long strands of steel cables drilled into the bottom of the deck there, and those strands running as far as you could see. That was the temporary post-tensioning repair that they did to add the extra strength to the bridge to shore it up. There was also some carbon fiber wrapping around on the ground that, you know, is just very interesting to be in there. So what they're going to do now going forward to fix it is more carbon fiber wrap, more post-tensioning steel that's going to make up that final repair work. Now, a lot of people have been asking, okay, why has it been taking 20 months from the closure of March of last year to this November before we actually start repairing? What's the hang-up here? And SDOT's Mark says you can't rush a job like this.
Design and testing are extremely important so that we only have to do this once. So we wanted to get it right the first time, and that's why we're making sure that we're hitting all the steps.
And bridge engineer Donahue agreed.
There are many people and many things happening concurrently and have been since the day that we closed the bridge. So I challenge that it's taking so long. It takes as long as it needs to do it correctly, to do it right, because we don't want to find out after we put traffic back on the bridge that we missed something or did something wrong. Nobody wants that.
Yeah, nobody wants that. Cars and buses are expected to return to the bridge in the middle of next year, probably right around 4th of July, that general vicinity. And that's how long the repairs are going to take. And then they'll test a little bit, and then we'll put some load on there. But, yeah, very interesting to be inside
so those,
and realize.
Those are spectacular pictures. And so those cables in your picture, that's the repair. That's what was added?
That was added because the steel for the bridge, the post-tensioning, was inside the concrete.
That's a lot of extra weight, though, isn't it?
Yeah. But when they pull it tight from either end, you're compressing the concrete on the bottom and making it a little bit stronger. So yeah, that's what they're gonna be running these all the way along the span as they do their full repair work. But yeah, all that stuff inside is new. It was just a hollow box before that. And I've got some more pictures. I might post some more as well. But it's always interesting to get inside and get a firsthand look to kind of. So you have a better idea of what you're talking about. I don't think a lot of people realize the inside of that thing is hollow. And it was the steel that failed. It basically stretched like a rubber band, and eventually it didn't get tight again, and that's what started the cracking. Mm.
Okay, the other big transportation issue is that Sound Transit's going to have a new boss. What happened to Peter Rogoff?
I'm sitting at my computer yesterday finishing up and working on those pictures on the West Seattle Bridge, and all of a sudden I see a tweet, and I'm like, what the heck? And then I immediately go to the Sound Transit board meeting where they were going to be discussing whether or not to renew Peter Rogoff's contract for another year. They do it every year. They do it on a one-year basis. And the members had gone into a long closed-door executive session, and when they came out, they were like, yeah, we're going to go in a new direction. We're like, what? It was a 14-3 vote, and Rogoff's out of a job that he's held since 2016. Now, he says he's going to stay on through the second quarter of next year or until a new CEO is chosen. And, you know, this comes with Sound Transit facing a $6.5 billion budget hole that we created by the pandemic. Also comes in a very difficult decision to delay the projects promised to voters under ST3 they just finished with. Also following a report that highlighted management problems like waiting until final design before they actually look at the costs and then realize, oh my gosh, we're $500 million over budget, which has happened. But in the end, it really turns out that this decision was likely started by Rogoff himself, who had told the board chair, Kent Keel, that, you know, after 6+ years and the amount of work he's doing, he's getting kind of tired of
it. The job of heading an agency that is executing the largest transit expansion program in America, all while operating service every day, really is simultaneously exhilarating and exhausting. The exhilaration never really wanes, but the exhaustion sometimes spikes.
And so he didn't see himself going on past next year, so they decided, okay, well, let's start looking for a new person now. Peter will help us get through this transition as we open up Northgate next month, or actually in 10 days or so. And Rogoff says he'll continue to be Sound Transit's biggest cheerleader going forward.
This assignment has easily been the most challenging, but also the most rewarding job I've had in my 40-year career, and I am grateful. Most of all, I'm grateful to our outstanding staff who allowed me to stand on their shoulders and get too much credit for their hard work.
Now, board members that spoke in open session thanked Rogoff for his hard work, but silent were critics like Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin and King County Executive Dow Constantine. Board Keel read a statement into the record after the vote, which included this.
All but one of Sound Transit's seven major construction projects are on time and performing on or below budget. putting the agency on a very solid path to nearly triple the size of its light rail network over the next 3 years while it continues to advance further expansions.
So the search for a new CEO will begin immediately as they transition away from Peter Rogoff.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. A 21-year-old college student was finally able to take notes in class. She didn't need to borrow a pen, though. She needed to borrow a pair of arms.
I always wanted to go to HBCU, so I decided what's better than the first. So I chose Lincoln.
HBCU stands for Historically Black College or University, and in this case, Imani Lamar chose Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. She tells WPVI-TV that she had just returned to classes after giving birth to her son, who was born premature and had to spend months in the NICU.
It was really hard. Every day going to the hospital and seeing him, not being able to help him, and it was hard.
When she told Professor Dr. Akil Dix she had to miss class again because she couldn't find a babysitter, his answer was no.
No. He told me no. And I just was looking at him like, no, I can't miss class. I don't have nobody to watch my baby.
I'm not going to have one of my students miss class because they have no one to watch their child. That's just not an option for me.
Those arms she needed to borrow? Dr. Dix's. He was happy to hold her baby so she could take notes in class.
That's my character. You know, I don't mind helping my students wherever they need me.
Lamar had reservations about bringing her baby to class, of course. How would the students react? Would he be a distraction? Would she be able to focus? But she says when Dr. Dix started lecturing, something changed for Lamar.
I never thought that it would ever come to that, and to have somebody who's there for me, who really cares and genuinely wants me to finish and finish strong, it meant a lot.
Lamar is now a few months from graduating. Oh, so sweet. I love this. And ever since I became a parent, of course, I go out of my way to tell parents when they're having a hard time with their kids, you're doing a good job. I'll
and there it is again. From we heard this from the teacher of the year we talked to a few days ago. Mm-hmm. Nothing gets a student to perform like a teacher who proves that he or she cares, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, from the G and Ursula show, it starts at 9 right here in Cairo Radio. Here's G Scott. Happy Blue Friday, G. Mm-hmm. And here we have the Seahawks with one win and one loss, and the Vikings, the opponent this Sunday, zero wins, two losses. So it sounds like we're facing another hungry team. Why can't we face a team that's had plenty to eat before they get to the stadium?
And you got that right. You are facing a Minnesota Vikings team that is hungry. They have lost two games. They're 0-2, but they've lost those two games by a combined 4 points. The road isn't going to be easy. The Seahawks' schedule is not going to be easy. The next three games are going to be tough. They play the Vikings, they play the Niners, and then they come home for Thursday night football, and then they play against the Rams. It's not easy. Let's talk about this opponent right here in the Vikings. Now, here's their deal. Their problem is they have a head coach that doesn't really connect well with the players. He's got that old school rah, rah, rah that doesn't really work anymore. For an example, if you come to work and somebody screams at you, are you going to be good at work?
No.
Probably not. These new days are different. Nobody's screaming at anybody. It is all about respect. So on one hand, the Vikings have that problem. They have kind of a coaching player representation, that kind of connection happening. However, the Vikings still have talent. They have very good talent, and they can compete with any NFL team out there, and it's going to be tough this Sunday. What am I looking for? I am looking for, will the real Seattle Seahawks stand up? And what I mean by that is this is going to be a game, Colleen and Dave, in which we find out who this team really is. Yeah, they won the first game out there in Indianapolis. That was a great win. We're like, oh my goodness, there was no pressure. They won that easily. Then they came home against the Titans. And in the first half, we're like, oh man, here we go again. Another win. This is going to be such a great season. And then by the end of the show, the potato salad wasn't even gone. There was still stuff in the crock pot. By the end of the game,
there was raisins in the potato salad.
I was not going to say that, and do not disrespect Dave Ross. You know Dave Ross likes raisin in his potato salad. Now, before long, the Seahawks lose that game. So, Colleen, we're going to find out if this is the real – who will the real Seattle Seahawks please stand up?
Well, who's hungrier? Is it the two lost Vikings or is it the one lost Seahawks? Because both teams are going to come out swinging.
Great question. I'm going to say – the Seattle Seahawks. And here's why. No. I know people are thinking, oh, you're just jumping on their side. No, hold on. Earlier this week, Pete Carroll had some things to say and just was kind of like, hey, I wish Russell would have kind of gave us more there, if you will, in that overtime possession. He didn't get any completions. He didn't move the ball down the field at all. Wish he could have gave us more. Stop right there. That's all number three Russell Wilson needs, a little bit of motivation. So Colleen, I say the Seahawks.
What if Sierra said to Russell, you better win? We would win every game, right? If Sierra could just crack the whip a little bit more on her husband, we would win.
Wait a minute. This is a morning.
It's always the wives when they lose. It's always the girlfriends when they lose.
This is a morning family show. You are not allowed to bring up football, whips, and motivation.
And Sierra.
Dave, what is going on around here?
Could I ask what is the what's the injury situation? Because they need somebody who can run the ball, right?
Yes. And when you start talking about the Seahawks, I'm glad you bring that up, Dave. Last week, I believe that's the reason why the Seahawks didn't win. I'm not blaming the run game, but the one thing that is consistent when the Seahawks win is when they rush for more than 100 yards. Well, they rushed for 77 yards in this game against the Titans that they lost. And look, that's how you gain control. That's how you keep the ball and you keep the other offense from getting the ball. So I would like to see the Seahawks, Chris Carson, everybody in that run game. I would like to see the running backs in the run game be successful this Sunday out there in Minnesota.
So, predict the score for us. After all that, what's the score going to be?
The score is going to be 31-28 Seahawks. Yes, I do believe on Sunday it is going to be a nail-biter. I do believe it's going to be one of those blood pressure raisers. I do believe that if you do have raisins in your potato salad, it won't be too kind later on. It is going to be one of those games in which it's going to be tough.
Okay,
because I think the Minnesota Vikings are good. Yeah.
One more thing. Predict the score of the Ohio State-Akron game tomorrow.
Good point. I'm going to say the Ohio State Buckeyes 57, Akron 7.
But Akron's a hungry team.
I watched some of their film.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it because it could go viral. I'm not going to say it. But, bless their hearts.
Okay. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Have a good time.
Thanks, guys. Take care, Colleen. Colleen, don't. This is a morning show, okay?
Okay, I will.
She's got 9 to noon with Ursula right here on Cairo Radio. It takes us
just
to 7.
To make you blush, Dave. That's all.
7. I don't know what anybody's talking about this morning.
Got to match the watermelons on your big shirt today.
You can ring my bell. Ring the bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's talk about the national parks, which are being loved to death. Here is Rachel Bell. You've been to national parks, right?
Yes, I just came back from Acadia National Park just a few days ago, actually, in Maine, which is a place I hadn't been before. And so there's an article out right now in the Wall Street Journal that says crowded national parks have turned to reservations. Some are considered keeping them. And I actually encountered this in Acadia. So there's a really, really popular road that leads up to a big view that people like to go to. It's called Cadillac Road, I believe, Cadillac Summit Road. Mm-hmm. And you had to get a reservation in advance and they gave you a time. So you had this like 30-minute window that you could arrive. And I think you could spend like 2 hours there. And so this is something that a lot of parks started doing during the pandemic because national parks were already super busy. But when people couldn't travel and leave the country and everybody was going on a road trip, national parks became even more crowded. I'm sure a lot of people listening are shaking their heads like, yes, yes, yes. Because this happened to me last summer in Rainier National Park, where we tried to, you know, get into one of the main entrances so we could park and do a hike. And there were actually police there cordoning off the road and said, there's so many people, it's a 3-hour wait to get a parking spot. And so, you know, we left and we did something else. But parks including Glacier in Montana, Rocky Mountain in Colorado, they are using these ticketing systems. And this year was a pilot program, but they're talking about putting it in place probably forever until things settle down, which may never happen again. So in Glacier National Park in Montana, they saw the highest year-to-date visitation on record this year. And part of that is because there were more flights to Glacier, 100,000 more seats in 2021 compared to 2019, which was the last big tourist season. And so what they did, there's a very popular road I've been here to called Going to the Sun Road.
Yes, I've been on it.
You've been on it too. Yeah. And when I went, I took the bus that they provide because I was told like it's so crowded. And so that was one solution. But what they did this year was they required people to make a reservation in advance, and you had to pay $2 a ticket between 6 a.m. and 5 p.m. if you wanted to use the road. Because what had happened before is if it got too congested, they just closed the park's west entrance. So they said if they hadn't put this reservation system in place this year, they would have had to close that entrance at least 35 times during the summer season.
Wow.
So even though a lot of people don't like this because not everybody knew and they showed up and they didn't know they had to make a reservation and they were upset that they came all this way and they couldn't see it, they may not have gotten in anyway because they could have arrived during one of those 35 instances that it would have been closed completely. And they said, quote, "We have no other alternative but to figure out how to manage the overcrowding." So I mentioned Maine. They said that Cadillac Summit Road, usually because people go to see the sunrise, usually 450 cars will show up for sunrise and there's only 170 spaces. So I actually think this is a good thing because, you know, if you're one of those cars that can't get a space, you're not going to get to see the sunrise anyway.
Right. Especially those little roads up in the mountains, they only have so much capacity. So what else are you supposed to do? Of course, what you could do if you wanted to control the large numbers of people is don't let them drive. Make them walk.
Oh, from home. They should have to walk from home.
No. But once
limiting
you get
in, traffic altogether.
Once you get, because when we went to Glacier, we parked at the bottom and we had to walk all the way up to Sperry Lodge, which took us, I don't know how many hours, but that will naturally limit the number of people.
It's true. I did that at Machu Picchu. I walked up from the bottom.
See?
Yeah, see,
Did you encounter huge crowds of people who'd walked up?
No. People took the bus or they did, you know, the big hike in. But yeah, not that many people do it. I think this is good. I just don't see any way around it. You know, I think they need to do a better job of informing people to know that there are reservations to be made, however they need to do that. I mean, I will say when you go on a lot of the websites for the national parks and the state parks, they're not always super modern. They're not like the best websites. So I feel like, you know, they have to somehow get this news out more. If you make a reservation to camp within the national park, they should, you know, send you an email and let you know about this. And I think what they need to do is they need to put in more of those shuttles and buses because that takes care of a lot of the problems. And I don't believe they have that at Rainier. They had it at Acadia. They have it at Glacier. And that helps because then, you know, you can still go to the place, even if you can't drive. But in Rainier, you're just kind of stuck. You can't do it.
Basically, what you're going to have to do, I'm sorry to say, and it's going to be expensive, is just you're going to have to build a bunch more national parks because there's just not enough of them to accommodate all the people who want to go.
They did just establish a new one in the last 2 years in Virginia. I think that was kind of Obama's last hurrah that he did that. So there's one new national park. Go to Virginia.
There you are.
I think that this is frustrating for people, but it's just Americans are frustrated by anything that doesn't go their way. And this is just kind of how it is, you know, like, make a reservation, kind of plan your vacation around that. You have to respect that the parks are getting overrun. And I think it's a better experience if they limit it for everybody. Once you get in, it won't be so crowded.
This could be a new market niche for Las Vegas, which is famous for building famous places in miniature. So why don't they just have a portion of the city which is dedicated to miniature versions of the national parks, which have great views but are much easier to hike, perhaps with escalators or something.
Maybe we should stop talking about all these news stories about being healthy and getting outside and just have people watch Planet Earth on TV.
There it is.
You're exercising your eyes and your right to relaxing in your own home.
Yes. Another great idea. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.